Welcome back, everyone, to the front line with Joe and Joe. Joe Pasillo and Joe Resinello.
Oh, you're exactly right, Joe.
We work for the man upstairs, as you do.
You're setting me up quite well. You just gave me an alley-oop.
The greatest revolutionary act you can commit right now is to open your mouth and speak the truth.
Whether you're an academic or you're a regular guy, we have to be fearless.
And once more, dear brothers and sisters, let us go into the breach.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the front line with Joe and Joe. Joe Pasillo, as always, joined by Joe Resinello. And once more, dear brothers and sisters, let us go into the breach on the Veritas Catholic Radio Network, 1350 on your AM dial, 103.9 on your FM dial, spreading the truth of the Catholic faith to the New York City metropolitan area. Two things, please download the app, share it with your friends. You'll have access to all of our station's content. And hey, if you like what Joe and I do, you can find us on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Rumble, the whole nine yards. Wherever you see us, you know, give a like, give a share, give a subscribe. Really help us out and get the message out there. That we would be very grateful to that. So for that. Today, we're very honored to be joined by Larry Chapp, and we are going to be discussing Larry's new book, Confession of a Catholic Worker, Our Moment of Christian Witness. Joe, I'm looking forward to this conversation because, as we say on the show all the time, when we have on guests like Larry, Joe and I learn as much as our audience does. So we're very grateful to Larry for coming on the show. Some of you have heard of Larry Chapp. Having said that, a brief bio. Larry Chapp, PhD, is a retired professor of theology who taught at DeSales University for 20 years. He received his doctorate from Fordham University in 1994 with a specialization in the theology of Hans Erwin Balthasar. He is now the owner and manager of the Dorothy Day Catholic Worker Farm near Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. Larry Chapp, thanks for joining us here at the front line with Joe and Joe, brother.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's going to be a lot of fun, I think.
I have that feeling. I'm just throwing it out there. Speaking of throwing it over, I'm going to throw it over to Joe Resinello and we'll get rocking.
Larry, we always start with a prayer to Our Lady. In the name of the Father, Son, Holy Spirit, amen. Remember, O most gracious Virgin Mary, never was it known that anyone who sought your help or sought your intercession was left unaided. Inspired by this confidence, we fly unto you, a virgin of virgins, our mother. To you we come, for you we stand, sinful and sorrowful. O Mother, the Word incarnate, despise not our petitions, but in your clemency hear and answer us. Amen. In the name of the Father, Son, Holy Spirit. Amen.
Great prayer.
Got to do it. Memoraries, yeah. Nine of them. I pray nine before every interview, Larry, because we need all the help we can get.
That's great.
I got to tell you. We got a lot in common. One, I went to the University of Scranton. You live in Wilkes-Barre. Know the area very well. I was educated by the Jesuits. You taught at Fordham. I actually go to Mass next to their campus in Manhattan at St. Paul's. I work near there. So I know the area. I see the students every day. Let's talk about a good place to start when we're talking about Catholic workers. Peter Marin, Dorothy Day. I'm a big fan. I think they're very misunderstood, both by traditionalists as well as the quote-unquote progressive Catholic Church. Talk about them. Talk about the Catholic workers movement that they started, just to begin.
Okay. Well, that's a great lead, and that's a great beginning. What's interesting about Dorothy Day, let's start with her. I mean, she wasn't raised a Catholic. She was raised some kind of, I think, Episcopalian sort of a thing, but in a very typical lukewarm way. She grew up to be not very religious. And then in her youth, she aspired to be a journalist. She lived for a while in Chicago, then New York City. She knew people like Eugene O'Neill and people like this. You know, she moved in the avant-garde circles, and she became also very interested in the plight of the working poor and the destitute. And boy, remember, this is the 1920s we're talking about. There weren't yet labor unions or labor laws and so on. And I mean, labor unions were controversial, even. That's communist. And so on. So she got involved sort of in Marxist agitation for left-wing political causes. But long story short, she eventually, you know, her religious sense kicks in and she begins to realize that Marxism did not have all the answers that she was looking for. And eventually she sees what she's looking for in the social teaching of the Catholic Church, which then leads her into Catholicism. She converts. She has her new child baptized. She ends up leaving her common law husband, who did not like her conversion. And she wanted, now that she was a Catholic, she wanted to get married. He said no. And so she had to depart from that. But then, you know, she was now looking, where do I go? Where I have all of this, these desires to live a radical life of some kind on behalf of the poor, on behalf of the downtrodden, and I'm a Catholic, where do I go? That's where Peter Morin comes in. Peter was a French self-taught kind of peasant fellow who eventually comes to Canada, then the United States. And he kind of just, he was a kind of vagabond, really, and a bit of a dilettante. And he traveled from one place to another. But he had all these big intellectual theological ideas about how to transform the world and the church. So he and Dorothy meet up in like 1929 or so. He visits her in New York City. And he then gives her the intellectual and theological foundation to her newfound Catholic faith. He became her intellectual theological mentor. He was a very, very bright guy, very self-taught, but very bright. And they eventually decide both of them, what we need are these houses of hospitality. We need a radical commitment to the poor. And so they start the Catholic worker movement, these soup kitchens in New York City, for starters, and they launched the newspaper, the Catholic Worker, which was a direct hit at the Marxist paper, which was called the Marxist Worker or whatever. Dorothy wanted it to be the Catholic alternative to that. All right. And so that's how the movement got started. Then they eventually added some Catholic worker farms. The movement spread across the country. They were pacifists, however, and their movement took a big hit during World War II, as you might imagine. Their stance against World War II was not very popular. But then after the war was over, the movement began to pick up steam again. However, in the modern world, I think the Catholic worker movement kind of went off the rails just a bit. As you pointed out, traditionalists were very skeptical of it because they thought it was all communist or Marxist or whatever, and thought Dorothy Day was a communist. She was. She was a very Orthodox Catholic. Dorothy and Peter were both very, very Orthodox Catholics. They believed everything that the church teaches, even on the morality stuff, the sexual stuff. And so, but the trads thought, okay, she's communist. But the progressives then said, oh, she's a social justice warrior. And so they just turned her and her movement into simply fighting for sort of trendy left-wing causes. Now, some of those causes I applaud, anti-war, that kind of stuff, but there's not a whole lot of Catholic identity left in many, many Catholic worker houses. And I get a lot of hate mail from Catholic workers for saying that and saying that publicly, but I stand by it and I think it's true. And that's why, you know, I think a lot of progressives don't understand Dorothy Day. They don't want to hear that she was a conservative Catholic. By modern standards, Dorothy Day was a conservative Catholic. Yeah, radical for the poor, anti-war, that kind of stuff, but very conservative in her approach to the magisterium and the teaching authority of the church.
The thing, Larry Chapp's joining us here at the front line with Joe and Joe. Please go out and buy his new book, Confession of a Catholic Worker, Our Moment of Christian Witness. That's available at Ignatius Press. Please support our Catholic publishers as well as our authors, and please support Ignatius Press. Let me take it a step further, Larry. Let me stay right there. Catholic social teaching. Now, I remember, this is several years ago, I was on my journey to being a more faithful Catholic. I never left the church, but I certainly wasn't practicing for a good portion of my adult life. But I started to read more about Catholic teaching. I remember reading Rerum Novarum. Now, I, back when I was young and stupid, was a knee-jerk, laissez-faire type mindset, capitalist, more a little bit more ideological. Rerum Novarum, and I found in that document, and I read later on Quadragesimo Anno, okay, and eventually Centesimus Annus, which was written by Pope John Paul II. These are all Catholic social teaching. These are all topics that are very relevant. In fact, Rerum Novarum is translated for our audience out there. New things. What was Pope Leo writing about? Consumerism, capitalism, and communism. Talk about that, because I think there's a skewed view amongst Catholics that if you're a conservative Catholic, as you mentioned, faithful to the magisterium, then somehow you have to be, you can't question free markets, or you can't question capitalism. Or if you actually suggest that there's a right that the business owner has, and then all of a sudden, well, you're anti-worker. Not so, Larry. And I'd like for you to kind of, I think that you know where I'm going with this. I'd like for you to clarify this. Because the Catholic, the union movement, the labor movement in this country, before it was infiltrated by the communists, was really, correct me if I'm wrong, predominantly a Catholic movement. It was almost embodiment of Rerum Novarum. Please talk about that.
Well, one of the reasons why the early labor movement was so populated heavily with Catholics is because most of the downtrodden workers of this country were Catholic immigrants from places like Italy, Ireland, Poland, and so on. And they had all the lowest rung jobs in America, from coal miner and you know, steel worker and factory workers of all kinds. And their conditions were horrific. So, yeah, there was a heavy Catholic involvement in that labor union movement. But let's back up a second. Yes, the church fully teaches and embraces, and so did Dorothy Day and Peter Morin, the notion that free markets are a good thing. A regulated, hyper-regulated communist economy is not a good thing. Free markets pertain to the freedom of each and every one of us to sort of live our lives by maximizing the gifts and goods that God has given to us, and we are to do something with them. But we have to make a distinction, and this is what Leo does in Rerum Novarum, and then Pius XI and John Paul II, and of course, Dorothy Day, Peter Morin, and many, many others. You have to make a distinction between free markets as such and capitalism as it came to develop in the United States. Not to go into too much history, I mean, there were a lot of greedy jerks who ran corporate America, you know, and they were called the robber baron capital before there were anti-monopoly laws and labor laws and so on. You had these guys that were accumulating these massive amounts of wealth, and you had this tiny little pocket of super wealth at the top and then huge pockets of destitution at the bottom with extremely dangerous working conditions. They had children as young as 8 years old, you know, working in coal mines for like 10 cents a day and nonsense like that. All the while, these fat cats are getting rich. And so what you saw was the emergence of corporate capitalism in the United States. And in many, many ways, corporate capitalism seeks to curtail free markets. That's why eventually we had to, you know, have these anti-monopoly laws, because once you get a monopoly on something, there's no such thing as a free market. Okay, and as you get super rich, then you can buy up your competition and then dismantle it and get rid of it. And so slowly over time, what emerges is this extremely unfair and unjust form of capitalism that eventually led to the Great Depression.
Larry, can I just ask one quick question while you're there? Okay.
Yeah.
Tell me if I'm wrong. Okay. I don't want to stay on this too long because we really want to get back into your book, but I think it's important for our audience to know. The way I look at it is this: on the one hand, you have the communist worldview, which is state ownership of the means of production. But when you look at what we have now, I don't look at what we have now as a free market economy. I look at what we have now as what you would call, I think, a corporatist or fascist economy, which is big government, same concentration of wealth now as it was 100 years ago, all right, in the hands of very few people, rather large corporations, rather large government, and big labor all coming together. Correct me if I'm wrong. Both of which are antithetical to what we would refer to as beneficial free markets.
That's right. And it's the opposite of free markets. That's why Dorothy Day and then Catholic thinkers like Hilaire Belloc and G.K. Chesterton, they proposed an economic system called distributism. And distributism was the idea, yes, free markets. And they wanted to emphasize small business ownership, and that free markets and small business ownership should be dispersed widely to as many average people as possible. So it's a kind of pro-small business approach to economics rather than the huge corporate colossus that gradually overtook America. And even the labor movement then eventually succumbs to the corporate colossus by becoming its own corporate colossus. You know, the Jimmy Hoffas of the world ended up as fish bait, apparently, or somewhere buried in the Meadowlands. Apparently.
He lives near me.
Under Giant Stadium, I heard.
I'm in the shadows of Giant Stadium. I live in Southern Bergen County. So, yes, I'm familiar with the tale.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
So, you know, you look at Rerum Novarum and what Leo was proposing. If you read it, what he's essentially saying is this: if everybody lived virtuous lives, then labor would treat management with respect. Management would treat labor with respect. And so what is lacking in all of this, that no system can change, whether it's communist or capitalist or whatever, if society lacks basic Christian virtues like honesty and hard work and fair play and decency, If it lacks those things, then no economic system is ever going to be just. So if you read what Leo's saying, it says we can avoid all of these excesses if we embrace the Catholic concept of virtue as the seeking after the sort of the golden mean, the golden mean. There's also an element in Catholic social teaching that harkens back to St. Thomas Aquinas. Aquinas taught what's called this notion of the universal destination of goods. And that's a fancy way of saying that nobody ever owns something absolutely, that all the goods of this earth are ultimately destined to be enjoyed universally by all. That's what Aquinas meant by the universal destination of goods. So that private property, though important, is not an absolute. And so even the wealth that I gain and the profits I gain from my own hard labor is not something that I possess absolutely. That charity still imposes upon me an obligation to use my possessions for the sake of the common good. And so Leo is pointing out that in lacking Christian virtue, nobody in our society is thinking about what is the common good. And if we just started thinking about the common good, both from the side of labor and management, then these things would just work themselves out properly.
No, I hear you, Larry. And again, that's why I'm glad I wanted to ask you that question, because the way I look at it, and I'm going to hand it over to Joe, we're going to continue talking about your book, Confession of a Catholic Worker, Our Moment of Christian Witness. The way I always looked at it was this: that document, in my view, is correct because it cheeses off both liberals and conservatives, mainly because I think with the way I always say it, Larry, I think the way you're saying it is that labor has rights, duties, and obligations. And that I think cheeses off, let's say, the Marxists. And then, but capital has rights, duties, and obligations. I think the key word there is obligations. That's what people like. Keep it moving. Joe Resinello.
I want to break down the social compendium of the Catholic Church a little more, because I think it's going to bridge us into Dorothy Day, who was radical and lived it. She was a gifted person, gifted writer. She chose to live poorly. She raised her child and she gave of herself. In a Jesuit school, we are always taught we're supposed to be people for others. You taught at one. I went to one. A lot of rich people at that school. I'm not condemning rich people. I believe in the capitalist system. But I also believe, and I'm glad you touched upon what Thomas Aquinas wrote, those who've been given much, much is expected. We will be judged based upon that. Now, that is something that rich Catholics don't like to hear. But that is a teaching of Jesus Christ. I read a book of the homilies of the Pope in Latin America. I've traveled through Latin America extensively. A lot of rich people. A lot of them are Catholic. The people who work for them make like $3 a day in some of these countries. That is a sin that cries to God for justice. I'm not condemning anyone to hell, but I'm just telling you what I see and what I have seen as I've traveled throughout the world, and I've seen a lot. Talk about that, because that is something I think that isn't talked about enough. We are a wealthy church and a wealthy people, and those who've been given much, much is expected and will be expected of you. Talk about that, because I'm going to be honest with you. You want to talk about pushing people out the door. That is one of those things like, oh my gosh, that makes people more uncomfortable than contraception being talked about inside the church. Don't touch my money. And we're rich as a country when it's compared to the rest of the world.
Absolutely. I want to correct one thing. I didn't teach at Fordham. I studied there. Taught at DeSales University, which is near Allentown, Pennsylvania. But I got my PhD at Fordham, and so I studied there. But just still, the point is the same. I was rubbing shoulders with some pretty wealthy people because Fordham has a wealthy clientele. I mean, only sort of the upper echelons can afford to go there on an undergraduate level. For graduate school, I was poor, but they gave me money to go there. Anyway. Here's the deal. You're absolutely right. You know, we can split hairs and split hairs and split hairs, but go and read the dadgum New Testament. And there's absolutely no way that you can come away from reading the New Testament and come away with the idea, you know, it's okay for me to accumulate vast amounts of wealth and not give a damn about my neighbor. There's no way to read the New Testament and not come away without thinking that the New Testament has a largely negative view of wealth. Jesus himself said, you cannot serve both God and mammon or money, because where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. And so you can fool yourself all you want. You can delude yourself all you want that I can own all of these things and have all of these shiny things in my life and all these wonderful things. But so long as I stay detached from them, then I'm doing the right thing and I'm okay and I'm safe. But then ask yourself the question, are you detached from them? Are you really detached from them? Could you live without them? If you could, then prove it by giving it away, giving most of it away. And also it ignores, it's psychologically and sociologically naive to say, I can surround myself with comforts and material possessions and wealth. I can surround myself with all of that, but I'm not going to be changed or affected by it at all. I'm still going to remain the same person that I always was, just a poor little humble boy from, you know, Lincoln, Nebraska, which is where I'm from. You know, I'm still the same. I guarantee you, if ever I got rich and somebody gave me $50 million and I retired to some, you know, beautiful tropical island, I wouldn't be the same dude. I would be changed and for the worse spiritually, which is why I wouldn't take the $50 million. Or if I took it, I'd give it away right away to somebody that would actually know what to do with it. Not me. All right. So, yeah. Go ahead.
No. Go ahead, Larry, please.
No, I'm just saying that, okay, so the Catholic Church in this country, in the United States, for the past 100-150 years, has for whatever reason decided, despite its throwing its weight behind the labor movement and so forth, or let's say since World War II, post-war era, with the great booming mainstreaming of Catholics into super affluent America, all right, the Catholic Church for the past 60-70 years has had this wonderful accommodation with that culture, where we've decided we'll just make the church safe for suburbia. We'll make the church beige and benign for the culture of the cul-de-sac. We even built churches that look like cul-de-sacs, nice and round and harmless, all right? Nothing provocative. And you got a priest who's going to stand, like you said, okay, a priest who comes, stands up and preaches against contraception is probably going to get a little bit of trouble and people are going to say, stop talking about that stuff. It bothers us. But a priest that would stand up and start preaching against wealth, against having too many things, about Catholics needing to lead a simpler life, materially speaking, and then he's probably going to get called in by his bishop and told, you know what, you need to stop talking like that. That sounds communist or something, you know, and the church has been, essentially therefore wallowing in this. Now, I'm not saying people have to run out and live like Dorothy Day. I don't live like Dorothy Day, and I have a Catholic worker farm. We can't all live like Dorothy Day, but saints like Dorothy Day are not meant to be imitated slavishly and literally. What they are is they're a provocation. They're the church's conscience. They're that little witness, that little example that gets into your brain and chirps away at you and reminds you that the world's things are not our ultimate destiny, that God is. And therefore, when we read about her life and we see her example and saints like her, like Francis of Assisi, we say to ourselves, yeah, I can have things, but I better darn well make sure that my life is otherwise oriented properly. Otherwise, these things are going to drag me down into the pit of destruction.
Greg Chapp is joining us here at the front line with Joe and Joe. We're discussing his new book, Confession of a Catholic Worker, Our Moment of Christian Witness, that's available at Ignatius Press. I think of it this way, Larry, you know, Jesus did not, in his parable of the prodigal son, or the story of the two brothers, however you want to say it, the father is wealthy. Jesus doesn't condemn the father. The father is, you know, I always looked at it this way. If I own a business and it's wildly successful, if I am treating my workers the right way, if I look at it as an enterprise within which people can thrive and prosper and build their families, that's the Catholic worldview. I think one of the problems, and I love your comments on this before we go to the break, one of the problems I think, even at what's considered to be left-wing American universities like Harvard, which business schools are all teaching the same thing, that your primary task as a business owner is to not only maintain a bottom line, is to grow that bottom line at whatever cost. That's the issue, is that you can get rich. And again, Jesus will judge us all, whether we're rich or poor, all right? You can be wealthy and be prosperous, let's put it like that, and own a business where your workers, if I employ 50 workers, okay, they're building their lives on my enterprise that I founded. I'm still making a lot of money. I might still have some of those shiny things, But I am acting as a Catholic because I'm because the lives of my workers mean something to me. Yes. I want them to be happy and I want them to build their lives. That's where I think capitalism goes off the rails, because we don't, because the business owner nowadays not only doesn't think that way, they're not taught that way, Larry. And like I said, supposedly left-wing institutions like Harvard Business School and Yale Business School. So I love a comment on that.
Well, yeah, first off, I'll just say this. Higher education in the United States is one monumental hypocrisy. And it's hypocrisy for exactly the reasons that you say. They talk a great deal about social justice, and all this critical this, critical theory that, and deconstruct this and deconstruct that. But when push comes to shove, when you look at what it is that they teach at their professional schools, like business school, like law school, it's all corporatism. It's all profits. It's all mainstream standard. Let's benefit from that 1% of wealthy Americans as much as we can sort of mentality. And of course, that brings money into those universities, big money. And so they're not about to cut off the cash cow. They're not about to poke the bear in the eye, because that's what pays their bills, even as they continue to charge their students $70,000 a year and so on. Social justice, my patootie. Okay. If you want social justice, hey, Fordham, tear down your wall. It's like Reagan to the Germans. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. All right. Well, Fordham talks a lot about social justice. It's in the Bronx, and yet it's got this nice, big, fancy brick wall all around it. Tear down that wall. Open up your campus. All right. Let's let the community pour in and avail themselves of your services, Fordham. All right. And then maybe we'll take seriously what you talk about with regard to social justice, and then take a good look at what you teach in your business school and in your law school. Are those schools promoting the values that your humanities and theology departments are preaching about social justice? I highly doubt it.
And that's the thing. That, I mean, my sister went to Fordham, like you said, she got boatloads of money to go there because my father and mother could not afford to send her to Fordham. I was always under the impression Fordham, Notre Dame, I'm not beating up on anybody. Okay, I'm not bashing them. But the bottom line is this: those schools were founded so that, as you mentioned earlier, the Catholic immigrants coming from Europe were going to be able to send their children to those schools. Well, how about the immigrants coming from Central and South America who are Catholic? Those kids can't go to Notre Dame. Those kids can't go to Fordham, unless they get some oppressive student loan. In other words, which we that's a whole other conversation. But anyway, I'm glad you brought that out, because, like you said, Larry, they should be living up to the principles that they say they espouse, which are Catholic principles. Larry, real quick before we go to the break, where can our audience, and we'll come back and we'll continue the conversation afterwards, where can our audience members learn more about what you have going on, and also the book, and where primarily they could buy the book?
Well, they can get the book either directly from Ignatius Press, or go to Amazon.com and just click in Larry Chapp or Confession of a Catholic Worker. But you can find all of my writing. I write for various journals. I also have my blog, GaudiumItSpez22.com. I know that's a mouthful, but that's what it is. That's the name of a document of the Second Vatican Council, Gaudium et Spes.
All right. Thanks for that, Larry. So we encourage everyone out there, like I said, to go out and buy the book. If you have to buy it from Amazon, go ahead. But if you have a choice, please buy it from the publisher, Ignatius Press. Larry Chapp's here with us at the Frontline with Joe and Joe. This is already a lively conversation. Confession of a Catholic Worker, our moment of Christian witness, of Larry's book, available, as I said, at Ignatius. You're listening to the Frontline with Joe and Joe on the Veritas Catholic Radio Network. Stick around. We'll be right back with another great segment with Larry Chapp.
Catholic radio works, and now we have it here in Connecticut and New York. It's been seen around the country that there's no better tool for evangelization. Where there's Catholic radio, the folks who listen deepen their faith, families are strengthened, parishes and communities flourish. So, let people know you're listening to Veritas, tell your friends to tune in, and let's make an impact here for Jesus and His Church. This is Steve Lee for Veritas Catholic Network.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Frontline with Joe and Joe, Joe Pasillo and Joe Resinello. We are way in the breach with Larry Chapp. We're discussing his new book, Confession of a Catholic Worker, our moment of Christian witness. Please go out and buy the book, and buy it from the publisher, Ignatius Press. Joe Resinello.
Larry, as we began the conversation, I basically said, like, you're a radical guy. You live on a farm. You live the Catholic worker ideal, I mean, you're not just an academic writing books in an office. I like that. Tell us about what you're doing. Tell us about what your farm's all about.
Yeah, I mean, the Catholic Worker Movement has these things called Catholic Worker Farms. And part of their goal is to simply raise food, grow food to give away to poor people. And we do that. But the deeper project of a Catholic Worker Farm is what Peter Morin called to develop what he called the agronomic university, which was his fancy way of saying something way before his time, that sort of back to the land, sort of homesteady type say today, that there is great spiritual value to be found in returning to the land and returning to the rhythms of the land and nature. And so a great deal of what we do is we simply host volunteers who come here and help us with our sheep and our goats and you know, with the crops that we've planted. And we've had pigs in the past, not this year though, and so on. But then we have fellowship. We have a chapel on our farm. And if the groups bring a priest with them, we have mass. We do liturgy of the hours. My wife and I are Benedictine oblates like Dorothy Day. We do liturgy of the hours in the chapel. We do that with people who come. So a great deal of what we do here on a day-to-day basis is kind of educational, teaching people about the spirituality of Dorothy Day, Peter Morin, the social teaching of the church, and the spiritual teaching of the church in general. That's a great deal of what we do, teaching here at the farm.
Larry Chapp, let me ask you this. Okay, you mentioned St. Benedict, or you mentioned, you know, the being a Benedictine oblate. I am of the opinion that once you know something about the monastic movement, okay, after the fall of the Roman Empire, so if you take St. Benedict, okay, he went to Germany, he built the monasteries in Germany. Those monasteries civilized the German people. Now, I don't want to overgeneralize, but that's just the way it is. The barbarian tribes started to actually become civilized through ora et labora, prayer and work. Talk about the concept of work. And where I'm going with this is this. I'm of the opinion, after knowing a little bit, like I said, about Catholic social teaching and looking at the example, and by the way, the wealth that was built up by those monasteries through that hard work, okay, that labor is the source of all value. If there is no work, you are not going to build value. It's my argument against AI and robotics and all that kind of stuff, that people need to work, that it's labor that produces value. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, read John Paul II's encyclical Laborum Exercens, which is about precisely that, the dignity of labor. And I could not agree more. We need a whole theology of the dignity of labor to be sort of really emphasized in the church, because there's no substitute at all for the personal dimension in our economy. I share your concern with robotics and AI and all that kind of stuff. I'm sure there's an upside to all of those kinds of technology. There always is in any technological advance. But the downside is, yeah, are we going to lose jobs? Are we going to lose labor to machines? And to me, too, I think a great neglected thing is the dignity of even what we might consider menial labor. Just sort of, and I don't mean to demean anybody, I've done these jobs and I understand, you know, like working in a fast food joint, worked in a grocery store. I've worked as a janitor. All right. I clean toilets. Okay. And these are jobs that a lot of Americans look at and say, well, those are menial sorts of jobs without meaning. And therefore it's okay if a robot or a machine does those, because that liberates us from those kinds of horrible jobs. And I beg to differ. You know, 90% of the human race toils away day after day after day on jobs that I guess most of it would consider to be menial. And how many people, even without so-called menial jobs, run off to their jobs in their cubicles, and they might be making 200 grand a year sitting in a cubicle doing actuarial work or investment work or whatever. How many of them actually feel fulfilled by their jobs on some sort of secular metric? Very few. They go to work and I got to go to work in the morning. And so what we've kind of lost across the board, where we're talking about so-called menial labor or even sort of more white collar jobs, is the dignity of what we do as human beings when we work for something. What we've kind of lost too is that there's salvation in drudgery. Isn't 90% of our day devoted to things that we would call drudgery? just, if I could just get through this. And how many of us live for the weekend or live for the evenings because everything else we do is drudgery? We need to return to a sense in which even that kind of drudgery, we offer it up. We see spiritual value in it. We see dignity in it. We see significance in it. So, yeah, I think we need a great revolution in how we envision the dignity of labor.
I'm really glad you said it that way. Larry Chapp's joining us here at the Frontline with Joe and Joe, Joe Pasillo, Joe Rasinello. Go ahead, Joe. Where do you want to go?
Well, basically, I mean, if you look around in the world, we see globalism, we see secular humanism. In the church, there's a crisis. There's almost a revolution in the church. You have two different groups that see it in a different way. I like your approach because you basically say we have to be uncompromising and we need a witness. You see, I've listened to smart people, a lot of smart people like yourself come on this show, to be honest with you. I have a graduate degree. I have two of them. I've heard smart people. I work with smart people. Sometimes they're not so impressive. People who do are impressive. Those are the people who've always impressed me. And some of those people, frankly, aren't so smart. They're doers, though. That is what the world needs. This is what the church needs. We need doers, witnesses. That's what saints are. That's what Dorothy Day was. That's what Peter Maron was. They made you think. Talk about that, because I'll be honest with you, a lot of the nonsense that goes on in the Catholic social world with regard to the Twitter ridiculous conversations, they're just that nonsense, net zero outcomes. I'm not pointing at people, but my view of it, I don't listen to any of it, to be completely truthful with you. I watch doers. And that's what Dorothy Day was. That's what Peter Maron was. That's what you are, frankly. You're putting where your money where your mouth is. Talk about that. We need witnesses.
Well, I hope I'm doing it. That's for sure. But we do need witnesses. I like that a lot, that we need people who aren't just talking, that they're getting down in the dirt and they're actually doing what needs to be done for the sake of their families, for their church, for broader society. And the church right now is bogged down in a bunch of these binary super conservative versus super liberal types arguing incessantly on Facebook and Twitter all day long about Pope Francis this, Pope Francis that, Latin Mass this, Latin Mass that. All right. And yet how many of them actually do anything to in a sense, live the life of the gospel? And that's kind of the point of my book, which is that if we think the future of the church resides in some kind of hyper-traditionalism or hyper-progressivism or even this neoconservative fever dream of a someday Catholic America, where we bless nuclear bombs and capitalism America style, all right? And then every American war is a war for sanctity and righteousness and so on, you know, that kind of coming together of Americanism and Catholicism. So you got that in the middle, and then you've got the super progressive, the super trads, and how many of them are actually living the dadgum gospel? Okay, how many of them are actually cutting through the BS and the fog of all of those words, cutting to the chase and saying, who among us is taking up our cross and following Christ? Who among us is helping the poor? Who among us is helping families? Who among us is helping the working class? Who among us is fighting for the rights of people to be free of all kinds of degradations that our society imposes upon us today? Who is there? You know, and I'm going to say something controversial. We saw the chickens come home to roost in the COVID crisis, because what we had was a church of cowards during the COVID crisis, cowards that just bent over backwards. And because we're just nothing but words, whether it's conservative words or liberal words, words, when the government says shut down, no masses allowed. Oh, okay. Thank you. Thank you, government. That's what we're going to do now. We're just going to shut down all our churches. We've had saints that have gone to their death, you know, in Rome and in other dictatorships around the world for the right to go to mass, for the right to say mass. I'm a Benedictine oblate. My patron saint is St. John Robert. All right. And he was a Benedictine that fled England when Henry VIII took over, because all the Catholics were getting persecuted. He went to France But then his conscience got the better of him, and he went back to England to say Mass underground because Mass was outlawed. And guess what? He was found out, arrested, and executed. And why did he do that? Because he understood the sacraments are the lifeline of the church, and a church that rolls over and plays dead when the government says you can't have Mass, that's not a church worth following. And this is what I'm talking about. When push came to shove, the great test of the past 3 years for the church was, what are we going to do in response to COVID? And we just rolled over and we said, fine, we'll shut down. And we did all of that in the name of public health or whatever. All right. And I know that's going to be a lightning rod.
No, I love it. I love it.
No, yeah. Listen, Larry, to your point, Cardinal Dolan just came out recently and said, I have had to examine not my words, and I was very encouraged to hear it, because evidently something might be coming down the pike, okay, in the COVID regime. Cardinal Dolan came out and said, I had to examine my conscience, and I think we caved too quickly. I'm paraphrasing, but he says, I think we caved too quickly to the pressure from the government to shut down masses. He expressed regret at that decision. So it's not just you saying it. Cardinal Dolan said it, and he blamed himself, which I found encouraging. Let me say it like that. Let me stay where you are right now for a second, Larry, because Michael Hanby, he's an
friend of mine,
a friend of yours, at the John Paul II Institute. He said, "Chap, in your book, quote, Chap pierces through both the tired opposition of traditionalism and progressivism," and this is where I want you to comment more, "and the deadly mediocrity of the anonymous atheism that constitutes the omnipresent crisis of Christianity in the modern world." Because I know we've been talking a little bit more about the trads, the progressives. What does that mean, the anonymous atheism that constitutes the omnipresent crisis of Christianity in the modern world?
Now, thank you for that, because it's kind of like the core of the book. One of my claims is that Western culture in general is predicated on a procedural atheism. In other words, we're the first culture in the history of the world to base its social order, its entire social order and its entire culture, on the idea that God is a complete irrelevance to us socially, politically, and so on. Now, I'm not arguing for a union of church and state or anything like that. I'm simply arguing observationally and empirically, what was the net effect of this notion in our country, right? That God is a complete irrelevance at best and dangerous at worst to the construction of our culture and our politics. Well, the net effect of that is that you develop an entire society and an entire culture around the idea that faith in God is something utterly private. It's just, you know, and it's negotiable and it's optional. Like, you know, well, you like Whoppers. I like Big Macs. You know, there's no accounting for taste. Oh, well, you're a Buddhist. He's a Catholic. Yeah. Or he's an atheist. Oh, it doesn't matter. It's all subjective values. Who cares? Religion doesn't really matter in the big picture now, does it? What matters is the growth of the GDP. What matters is our latest foreign policy and all that. None of our society, therefore, has God as its focus. So this goes along with what I said, the cult of well-being. Our entire focus as a society is on penultimate or non-ultimate values. We've lost sight of the ultimate, and therefore our religious sense has grown weak, and our religious eyes have grown weak. Our spiritual eyes have grown weak. We have kind of spiritual cataracts on now. So what I like to say is this, that even among many, many Catholics and other Christians who go to church and say that they believe in God, among many, many of them, there is a kind of atheistic soul. There's a kind of quiet disbelief in their soul, a quiet atheism in their soul. So their faith is more of the Pascal's wager variety. I want God exists. I hope God exists. So I'm going to pretend that I believe in God, even though in my heart of hearts, I really doubt that God really does exist. It's kind of like a whistling past the graveyard kind of faith. And I know that sounds judgmental, but the reason why I recognize it is because I'm infected with the same bacillus of this disease. I sense it in myself. I'm raised an American, a middle-class, typical Midwestern American. I sense this in my own soul, this constant struggle with our culture dragging us down into the practical, into the atheistic, into the agnostic. And so our Christianity, our Catholicism has reflected that kind of tepidness. That's why our Catholicism is lukewarm. neither here nor there, because we have it, but we don't want to have it too much. I'll go to church, but I don't want to be a fanatic after all. All right. And the church responds to that by, in a sense, giving us a very safe, as Bishop Barron calls, beige religion, not bright red or bright gold or bright green, beige.
Because beige fact is, our religion is supposed to be bright red, red representing the blood of Jesus Christ. And I'm glad you said that. I'm going to hand it over to Joe. I want to keep it moving. But I'm glad you said that, because the Catholic worldview is correct, especially if you apply it, Larry, to America, because if you had an authentic Catholic world application of Catholic worldview in America, you'd piss off both the liberals and the conservatives, because the Catholic Church is communist in the mind of the conservatives, and they're fascist in the mind of the sexually progressive left. So that's how you know you're on the right track, when you choose off both sides. Let's keep it moving. Joe Racinello.
I want to talk about that witness, because you can't learn that through reading. You have to live it. Mother Teresa said you are humble through humiliation. She also said this when asked, how is your order going to go on without you? She said, if they do two things, it'll go on. They embrace poverty and they have a Eucharistic focus. Why do I talk about that when you talk about a lukewarm Catholicism? You have to feel the burn of life to cling to God. Let's be real. If you don't, you're not going to, whether you're a cardinal or whether you're a worker. And that's what we're afraid to do. We take Jesus at his word. Oh, you believe in me, you're going to go to heaven. Really? He also said a lot of other things. Do we take him at his word? Oh, that means I'm going to be a little uncomfortable. Well, yeah, that's what it means. That's what it means. And that reflects in our Catholicism. We don't want to be uncomfortable. But when we're not, we won't be the people we're intended and supposed to be. That's what you're talking about, the way I see it. And that's where the rubber meets the road. What do you think?
I think that's exactly right. I love your passion, by the way, Joe, and I love the way you put it. The fact of the matter is, and Dorothy Day and others would say this, the everydayness of our life, the ordinariness of our life, which involves all these sorts of material comforts and creature comforts that the modern world gives us, is in some ways its toxicity to the faith is that it perpetuates a kind of illusion. And the illusion that it perpetuates is that we live in this bubble of material well-being, and through modern medicine, other things, I can stave off the worst effects of disease and so on. So I can live in this bubble, in this life, and not really have to concern myself with big issues and religion issues and ultimacy issues. And I'm just going to stay in this little safe bubble. The trouble is this, life isn't like that. The trouble is that bubble gets burst eventually. Okay, because into every single one of our lives comes a crisis of some kind or another, whether it's disease or death or some other kind of major tragedy in our lives. And in many ways, that's when the scales fall off of our eyes. And this is what Mother Teresa meant when she said, you learn humility through humiliation. I would also say you learn the true nature of existence through suffering, because this kind of material comfort and well-being and safety and stuff is not really reality. Reality is characterized by pain, suffering, disease, death, and various other tragic things like the loss of relationships or the estrangement of children. I used to work in hospice back when I was a seminarian at one time. And one of the things I noticed when I was dealing with people who were dying, anybody who works in hospice can tell you this, people on their deathbeds never say, oh, gee, I wish I'd taken that other job, or I wish I'd made a little more money, or gee, I wish I'd had that Ferrari I was never able to buy. No, when they're on their deathbeds, they say, I really wish I had not let my father die before I told him I loved him. I really wish that my child wasn't estranged from me. Nothing means more to them at that point than the relationships that they have built. And at that point, many people begin to realize, geez, I've wasted my life on all these other things. And that's what the illusion of that bubble does for us. It creates a false sense of reality. And so what Dorothy Day, Mother Teresa, John Paul, all the saints are there to remind us is that in the end, death is the reality that gets us all. Death. And eventually in that point, some crisis is going to come to your life. Any priest who's worth their salt will tell you, all right, that it is precisely in those crisis moments when people are most open to God. And I think in some ways, that's why God sends those crisis moments into our life. I know in my own life, I'm very prone to just sort of cruise controlling through life in my little comfort zone. And then something really nasty happens to me. And it's not until that happens to me that I'm shocked into the realization that I need God in my life, and I need prayer in my life, and I need charity in my life, and all those things.
Larry Chapp, there's a million things I want to ask you. And unfortunately, when it comes to radio, you know, you have hard breaks and a time limit. Larry Chapp joining us here at the Frontline with Joe and Joe, Confession of a Catholic Worker, our moment of Christian witness. Joe had put together so many more questions. I want to try to pick out maybe just one that I really want to focus on. Let's talk about this. I think we're really talking about a lot of what we're talking about is Americanism. I think you would agree. The idea of not just American Catholicism, but American Christianity and religion in general. What is the proper relationship between church and state? Because I think people don't. I think people just throw that around, separation of church and state. I mean, they don't even know what it means. What is the proper relationship from a Catholic point of view?
Well, the Catholic Church has always taught that it's the moral obligation of every individual and therefore of every government to seek the truth about God. And it has not abandoned that basic claim that we have an obligation to seek the truth about God. Catholicism stands four square against religious relativism and religious indifferentism. There is a true God and a true religion of that God, and it's the Catholic faith. That's not to say all other religions are simply false straight up and all the way down. But no, Catholicism is the truest of all the religions. Therefore, it's just simply an act of honesty. If a government recognizes the truth of the Catholic Church, that it acknowledges that, and that there is no separation of church and state, that in a strict sense, a Jeffersonian wall of separation, that the government is allowed to favor the Catholic Church so that it would fund, say, Catholic schools and those sorts of things. Now, that would be an ideal situation, I think, from a Catholic point of view, keeping in mind, too, that the Catholic Church would also teach that the government under no circumstances should ever persecute any non-Catholic religion ever, ever at any time, because as Vatican II taught, human beings have the right to religious conscience inherent in their human dignity. Therefore, given our cultural circumstances, I would say that the proper relationship between church and state right now would not be to try to work for the recognition of Catholicism in our society. I think that'd be very, it would never happen, by the way, and it would be counterproductive. So I'm just speaking theoretically, but on a practical level, where we are now, I just think that the best that we can hope for would be that our government at least not be hostile to our values. And up until recent modern times, that's the way our arrangement was. We had all religions were kind of equal before the government. We all had freedom, and the government, for the most part, kind of stayed out of our business. All right, kept out of our grill, and even had a certain respect for the kinds of charitable works that we do and so forth. But lately, there's been the rise of a certain hostility to our faith. With regard to LGBTQ issues and so on, and some mild persecutions taking place. I don't want to exaggerate them, but some mild persecutions. So I think what we should work for now would simply be to try and keep the government from being overtly hostile to us, which is very possible.
Absolutely. Joe Racinello, it's got to be quick. We have time for one more quick question and one more quick answer.
Well, I'll be honest with you. I think it comes down to this: fleeing from the cross. We have to embrace a Catholicism that does not flee from the cross, whatever station in life we are in. And this has to be lived by each of us. Talk about that, because, again, it is witness. Christ said, take up your cross and follow me. Do we take him at his word? I don't think so.
Yeah, the subtitle of my book is Our Moment of Christian Witness. And what that is meant to imply is that sort of middle of the road, status quo Catholicism is no longer possible. Standing still, treading water Catholicism is no longer possible. You're either going to be going deeper into your faith or you're going to be falling away from the faith. Our culture is simply going to impose that choice on us. Therefore, what does it mean to go deeper into your faith? It means to live the cross. The New Testament makes it very, very, very clear. To be a disciple of Jesus is to follow the way of the cross. and to embrace the crosses that come our way as gifts from Christ for our greater sanctification.
I love it.
Go ahead.
I mean, I'll be honest with you. I love it because that's what it's about. I always say this. If you don't have enemies, and I don't do this to have enemies, but I have them, you're not speaking for God and his church. Jesus had enemies. When you speak the truth, people are going to get in your face. People are going to push up against you. If you aren't taking up your cross, to be honest with you, you could write 75 billion books. You could have 15 radio shows. You could write articles. No one's going to listen. They're not going to listen.
That's right. That's right.
This is what we have to do. And I say this directly to not only the people in the pew, to the clergy. They got to start. You said it. It's a weak church.
Larry, we have a minute. I'd love some final thoughts from you for our audience.
Well, I think what I want to emphasize is that we can talk ideals and ideal situations, and here's what the church could be. Well, let's get down to brass tacks and pay attention to the culture in which we live. And it is a culture of desperate people, lonely people, people who are living lives of quiet despair in a kind of meaningless ocean of spiritual anxiety. And I think that, you know, just as it's darkest right before the dawn or whatever that phrase is, things look really bad right now culturally and for the church. And people are leaving the church left and right, left and right, left and right. And yet what people are ultimately seeking is a deeper and more authentic church. And I think out of the ashes of our shrinking church in Western culture, out of its ashes is going to emerge a church that is more sanctified and is going to reattract people to it. And that will be the lives of saints, the lives of those who live the cruciform path that I'm asking people to live. A church that is authentic and real and speaks to our humanity in deep and profound ways. That's the way forward, not the church of beige compromise.
Larry Chapp, I mean, that's a great place to end it. Please, everyone, go out there, buy the book, Confession of a Catholic Worker, Our Moment of Christian Witness. You can buy it at Amazon if you have to, but we would prefer that you buy it and support our Catholic publishers. Buy it from Ignatius Press. Larry Chapp, thank you so much for a lively conversation. There's so much more we could have gotten into. So hopefully you'll come back. You're welcome back on this show anytime, our brother.
I'd be happy to come back. And I'm sorry I talk too much and don't let you get your questions in.
Listen, in Italian, what they call guys like Joe and I back in Newark is chiacchierone. We can't shut up. So it's not just you. It's us too. All right. But Larry Chapp, thanks again, brother. We really appreciate you coming on. I'm being serious. Please, we welcome you back here anytime. We love conversations.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Let's do it. Thanks.
You got it. And thank you out there for joining us at the Veritas Catholic Radio Network, 1350 on your AM dial, 103.9 on your FM dial, spreading the truth of the Catholic faith to the New York City metropolitan area. Two quick things. Download the app, share it with your friends. You'll have access to all of our station's content. And wherever you see Joe and I on social media, please like, subscribe, share. All that fun stuff. Help us out if you can. And remember, until the next time, that our conversation is your conversation. And that conversation is going on everywhere. We'll talk to you soon.